of heaven.
Apavar gayaho.
And liberation.
And liberation.
Dwaram. The gateway.
The gateway.
Prapya.
Prapya.
Achieving.
Achieving.
Lokam.
Lokam.
The human life.
The human life.
Imam.
Imam.
This.
This.
Puman,
Puman,
a person.
A person.
Dravane,
Dravane,
to property.
To property.
Kaha,
Kaha,
who?
Who?
Anusacheta,
Anusacheta,
will become attached.
Will become attached.
Marchaha,
Marchaha,
prone to death.
Prone to death.
Anartasha,
Anartasha,
of worthlessness.
Of worthlessness.
Dhamani,
Dhamani,
in the realm.
In the realm.
Translation, what mortal man, having achieved this human life, which is the very gateway to both heaven and liberation, would willingly become attached to that abode of worthlessness, material property? So you repeat. What mortal man?
What mortal man?
Having achieved this human life.
Having achieved this human life.
Which is the very gateway.
Which is the very gateway
to both heaven and liberation.
To both heaven and liberation.
Would willingly become attached.
Would willingly become attached.
To that abode of worthlessness.
To that abode of worthlessness.
Material property.
Material property.
So purport by His Divine Grace, A.C., or actually servants of His Divine Grace, A.C., Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada.
Jai.
That which one intends to use for one's personal sense gratification is called material property, whereas paraphernalia to be used in the Lord's loving service is understood to be spiritual. One should give up all one's material property by utilizing it completely in the devotional service of the Lord. A person who owns a luxurious mansion should install the deity of the Lord and hold regular programs to propagate Krishna consciousness. Similarly, wealth should be used to build temples of the Lord and publish literature scientifically explaining the personality of Godhead. One who blindly renounces material property without utilizing it in the service of the Lord does not understand that everything belongs to the personality of Godhead. Such blind renunciation is based on the material idea that this property could belong to me. But I don't want it. Everything, in fact, belongs to God. Knowing this, one neither tries to enjoy nor to reject the things of this world, but peacefully engages them in the service of the Lord. So, Swarga Pavagayo Dwaram Prapya Lokam Imam Puman Travane Kona Sacheta Marchu Nartasya Dhamani. So, Omaganatim Vidandasha Gananjana Shlakaya Chakshur Unmeritam Yena Tasmai Shikadave Namaha. So the human life here and in the last verse is considered to be the doorway or dwaram. Dwaram means gateway or doorway to liberation and actually even to heaven. Although there are exceptions to that. I mean, sometimes you find dogs go back to Godhead, like in the case of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Well, a mala, or garland, as they say in English. So in the case of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu liberated two dogs. One when he was a kid, a little puppy, and one when he was in Jagannath Puri, and Shivananda Sen was taking care of that dog. The dog ran to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was throwing sandalwood, not sandalwood, the coconut pulp, green coconut pulp with the dog, and the dog was catching it, eating it, and getting up on his hind legs and chanting Hare Krishna, and he went back to Godhead. So there are different circumstances. I mean, for example, in Lord Ramchandra's army, there were some monkeys and some Kimpurushas. Actually, Hanuman was not strictly speaking a monkey. He's a Kimpurusha. It's like Kimpurusha means, is it a human being? That's literally the meaning of that word. And right now he's on Kimpurusha Loka. So he's like, you know, has some particular qualities of a monkey and some qualities of a human being. So it's not exactly the same as a monkey. But anyway, different species. He was a different species. The Kim Purush is a different species. So you do find from time to time, but these are the exceptions. So we are actually in human bodies now. Of course, there's 400,000 species of human life, and most of them are actually almost subhuman. And somehow or other, we have these bodies that are, I wouldn't say that they're not subhuman, but they're they have many inclinations that are subhuman to them. But still, they're human bodies, and we do have the ability to understand Krishna consciousness. As Prahlad Maharaj says, therefore we should utilize every moment. Komara charet pragyo, dharmam bhagavatam niha. Durlabha manasa janma tadapturuva martyam. Famous verse that he's preaching to his schoolmates. And he says, from the very beginning, because the schoolmates, as we know, had so many excuses. You know, we're kids, we can't do it. And Prahlad Maharaj actually says, you will always have excuses. Basically, I'm paraphrasing what he says. He says, like, at sometimes you're going to be a kid, so you'll have an excuse. Later on, you're going to be a teenager. You have an excuse. I'm a teenager. Later on, you're going to have an excuse. You're getting married. You're not married. Later on, you're going to have an excuse. You have to work. Later on, you're going to have to make an excuse. You're retired. And then you also have a good excuse, because 50% of the time, you're sleeping. So if you put it together, you know, you go, you get more than 100% of the time you got excuses for. And therefore, Prahlad Maharaj said, you know, no more excuses, he said to his schoolmates. Komara acharet. Acharet, the word acharet in Sanskrit is an imperative sense. It means must do. So you must do it from the very beginning. And when you engage children in some nonsense, rather than engage them in Krishna consciousness from the very beginning, guess what happens? What happens is that the children have all these sanskaras implanted in their hearts. Now, the interesting thing about sanskaras, generally when you talk about sanskaras, you think it's some big ceremony like Namakarana or Vivaha Yajna. These are sanskaras. But the actual meaning of the word sanskara is impression, which is interesting. In other words, when you're chanting Hare Krishna, if you're meditating on Krishna's pastimes, you're getting samskaras. What are those samskaras? Those samskaras are spiritual samskaras. And if you're doing something mundane, like we were talking about children before, if you're watching Mickey Mouse or Donald Duck or whatever they watch nowadays, then you get that samskara. I mean, for example, I can remember those early songs in my life, you know, M-I-C-K-E-Y-M-O-U-S-E. And Mickey Mouse, you know, Mickey, Minnie. I mean, I remember these names better than I remember the names of the devotees. Isn't it? I mean, so those are deep samskaras. Gata samskaras. That's described in the Jiva Dharma by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. These gata samskara means very deep samskaras. So we have these deep samskaras in our heart, actually from our childhood. Oh, Hare Krishna. Welcome. So, and basically, if we keep exposing ourselves and children and whatever to these different items that are not Krishna conscious, then we're actually increasing these deep Maya sanskaras. Now, it doesn't matter how many of the Vedic sanskaras you do. In other words, how many times you do a fire sacrifice or havan, as they say, or how many times you do some punya or pious activity. You still have all these bad sanskaras in your heart. So therefore, Prahlad Maharaj states that we should utilize every available moment. Komaram acharet pragyo. Dharmam Bhagavatam Nihap, because the human form of life, Durlabha Manasa Janma, Tadapdruva Martyram, is very difficult to get. In fact, most of the living entities in this world are not human, and I'm not referring to any of you. Because it's microscopic creatures, each and every cell of your body is a creature. There's in the air, in the ground, probably a few cockroaches running around, just like in my room this morning. We were surrounded by cockroaches.
That many?
Well, not hundreds of them. They came to hear Krishna Katha. And we liberated them. So, so we're in the minority, even in this room. I mean, the vast minority. It's like a 10 to the billionth power to one. That's practically the percentage. So it's very rare to have a human birth. So, therefore, it's pretty stupid, as described here. What mortal man, having achieved this human life, which is the very gateway to both heaven and earth, would willingly become attached to that abode of worthlessness, material property? However, Srila Prabhupada does give us, or Srila Prabhupada's servants, and quoting from the Acharya's commentaries, do give us a hint in how to get out of this attachment to material prosperity. And it's not the negation of material prosperity. As Srila Prabhupada points out here, that's called Phagu Vairagya. Phagu Vairagya means where you give up something and you speak negatively about it, but you're actually attached to it because, as Krishna says in the Gita, attraction and repulsion are felt by conditioned souls, but they're the same thing, the opposite sides of the same coin, as Srila Prabhupada said. Just like in the early days of the Hare Krishna movement, and even today, sometimes you find that young men speak disparagingly about women. You know, they say, "Oh, Maya Devi," right? They speak negative. That's because they're attached. Otherwise, they'd be neutral. Nirapeksha. Nirapeksha means just completely neutral. Just like one time, one sannyasi went to Prabhupada, and he was sort of joking with Prabhupada. Prabhupada had just finished telling the story of the Shakshi Gopal story, where the younger Brahmin had the deity walk all the way across India to witness the marriage promise that the older Brahmin had made. And you all know that story, I think, Shakshi Gopal. So what happened is the sannyasi heard Prabhupada describe the story, and also Prabhupada said that both the older Brahmin and younger Brahmin were pure devotees. And then this sannyasi said to Prabhupada, "But if he was such a pure devotee, why did he get married?" And then Prabhupada turned to him and said, "Because no one would have you. You're speaking like this." In other words. But Prabhupada was, it was a joking exchange. I mean, really, it's not that the sannyasi was serious about the whole thing, but he was joking about the whole thing. So Prabhupada said, "Because no one will have you." In other words, Prabhupada was indicating that perhaps a person like that would be just like bitter because he couldn't have happiness, therefore he was envious of the person who had that particular situation in life. So if we overly criticize something, that means basically we have some envy, that means that we'd like to have what they have. I mean, nothing wrong with envy. I mean, if we analyze envy rather than being non-empathic, if we're actually empathic with people and we analyze envy, it just means that we're missing something. Some of our needs are not being fulfilled. That's all. And just be honest. If you're honest about yourself, you give up envy, right? Envy is just a manifestation of not having needs fulfilled, to put it in an NVC nomenclature. Not having your needs fulfilled. So anyway, so basically, Prabhupada here is advocating a yukta vairagya. Yukta vairagya, phagu vairagya, let's describe what that means, false renunciation. Prabhupada describes that refers to the phagu river. Phagu also means, palgu also means crazy. It means crazy. Just like in Vrindavan, there's an advertisement, Phagu Baba. Anyone seen that? When you go into Vrindavan, Phagu Baba. It's a temple of the crazy Baba. Anyone seen that when they go into Vrindavan? There's a sign. Of course, the Bhangi Bihari temple is most famous. ISKCON is the second most famous temple in Vrindavan. And the third most is this Palgu Baba temple. It's the temple of the crazy Baba. I mean, it's just like Avaduta or something like that. So Phagu Vairagya, Prabhupada said, refers to the river called the river Phagu, which means the river appears to be dry. But underneath the surface, if you just like dig a little bit underneath the surface, there's the river running underground. I mean, really, just like a few inches underground. That's the Palgu River. That's where the Fagu Vairagya comes from. It also means false, also means crazy in Bengali.
There's a river like that.
Yeah, there's a river, but it's just like under the ground, so it appears like it's dry. So in the same way, it appears like you're very renounced, Prabhu, but actually right under the surface, you're filled with lust, anger, and greed. Which is interesting. That's where the word Falgu comes from. You know, Prabhupada indicates that. So, Prabhupada is advocating, or at least the Acharyas are advocating, Yukta Vairagya. Yukta Vairagya means you engage things in Krishna's service. Now, that's very interesting because we want to connect this with Krishna West, right? That was the advertisement for today's class. So, how to connect it with Krishna West. Because generally, we think only things that are, quote, Vedic can be connected to Krishna, right? Generally, you think, you know, you have to have, like, glabjamans, you have to have a sari, you have to have a dhoti, and that's the only thing that connects you to Krishna. You know, the external things connect you with Krishna. So this is a misunderstanding. Also, just as a side note, we don't even know what Vedic is. It's really interesting. Like, when they were planning the temple of the Vedic planetarium in Mayapur, there were so many complaints, this is not a Vedic building, no Vedic architecture. Well, and then they were presenting examples of other architecture in India that were actually Muslim architecture, or mixture of like ancient architecture and Muslim architecture, saying this is Vedic. But Prabhupada actually wanted a building more or less looking with a similar style to the Capitol building in the United States. That was Prabhupada's commentary. And, you know, and then after they started constructing the temple, many devotees said, well, it looks like the United States Capitol. But that's what Prabhupada wanted. That was what Prabhupada wanted. So, as far as understanding what Vedic is, I mean, let's take other examples like a kurta. You know, we all wear kurtas, we think they're Vedic, or some of you wear t-shirts. Actually, I was going to wear my Krishna West t-shirt this morning in class, but it was too cold. But kurtas come from Afghanistan. They don't come from India. There's nothing Vedic about them. And there's many other things you could talk about. The word, you know, the word dhoti is not there in the Vedic literatures. But what does Vedic mean? What does Veda mean? Veda means knowledge. Vedanta means the end of knowledge. And really, to understand Krishna, that means you're Vedic. So, anyway, and then we offer many, many things to the deities that we think are Vedic, but 5,000 years ago there was no sugar cane in India, 5,000 years ago there was no, there were no tomatoes, and we were talking the other day about something you call Radha Red. You think plum chutney is actually Radharani's favorite. There were no plums in India 5,000 years ago, so she never took plums. I mean, there in India. I'm not saying Radharani never took plums, but she, in India. So you think, oh, it's her favorite. And then you have one of Prabhupada's favorite sweets was cookies. I was in a car with Prabhupada one time. We went on a preaching program and I brought like a whole tray of cookies and I forgot to give them out to the people and I apologized to Prabhupada and Prabhupada said, all right, give them to me. And Prabhupada ate like 20 cookies, I guess. That's some brahmachari, you know. After preaching, like sometimes after preaching, Prabhupada got very hungry. You know, you see this, there's many stories about that. He got very enthusiastic and hungry. So there was something not Vedic, cookie. But people think if you're going to go distribute prasadam, you should be handing out glabjamans to people on the street. You know, that really would freak someone out. You give them a glabjaman and the sugar water is dripping down, getting on their clothes, and then they just go, oh my God, it's not the movement for me. I mean, the first time I got prasadam, somebody handed me a sweet ball in the street. And I go, what's this thing? If they had handed me a cookie, I would have eaten it. Because it was a sweet ball, I just threw it in the bushes. Because I couldn't relate to it. So, I mean, many things. I mean, like plum chutney. I mean, I can go through the whole list of things. Tomatoes, potatoes. You know, there were no potatoes in India. and so many, many things. I mean, we don't really even know basically what was there. I mean, there was honey. We know there was honey, that's for sure, because Krishna and the gopis were getting drunk on honey wine. That's described by the acharyas. So if you have to get drunk, that's Vedic. Yeah. I mean, you shouldn't go out and buy vodka or beer. That's prohibited, but honey wine is fine for the devotees. In the early days of the movement, we would take the nectar drink and let it ferment for a few days, and the devotees and brahmacharis would sit and drink it. You ever do that?
We call it rocket fuel.
I mean, I'm just going through the different items of dress like that. You know, that they're really, you know, what can you say, the items of food and items of dress? I mean, what is Vedic? I mean, do we actually know how Krishna dressed? I mean, if he had dressed in a dhoti, he probably would have tripped all over himself in the battle of Kurukshetra. It was obviously something like pants, you know, like cloth wrapped around his legs. You know, you see sometimes pants like that, not tight pants, not blue jeans. I mean, that's going too far. Like in the Bunki Bihari temple one day, they dressed Krishna in blue jeans, and they put a cell phone on his belt instead of a... Yeah. They actually did that. There's pictures of it. They dressed, and you know, that's too far. Yeah, that's too far. I mean, there's a limit. But still, you know, we don't want to impose a standard that really Krishna, that had nothing to do with what Krishna did, or we don't know if Krishna acted like that or ate like that 5,000 years ago. I mean, I was just reading a letter from Prabhupada this morning. Actually, someone sent me this. Krishna's getting angry. Oh my God. Someone sent me, you better turn this up, so I can be more powerful than Krishna. Someone sent me a letter, you know, asking, can we eat mushrooms? Now, I'm not advocating mushrooms. So I looked at Prabhupada's debate base, and Prabhupada, there's a whole quote where Prabhupada said, not generally offered or eaten, but there's no prohibition. That's one thing. But then Prabhupada said in the same letter, it was through devotee Harinam, who I knew quite well. Prabhupada said, you can make up your own recipes just as long as it's tasteful and to offer to the deities. Which is really interesting. In other words, according to the culture that you're in, not that you make up your own recipes, you go there like in a laboratory and you start throwing in, you know, everything on the shelves. What is that? From Macbeth, boil, double trouble, cauldron burn, cauldron bubble. Anyone here ever study Macbeth? It's not that you do that, but you can offer Krishna's promises something that's palatable, something that's tasteful. And of course, it has to be different items that Krishna should have a sweet. I understand all those things. But you're not really stuck with certain, like, Vedic recipes. Or what you think are Vedic, which may be not Vedic, like all your potato recipes, tomato recipes, and all these other recipes that you have. So, therefore, the point is, as Prabhupada said, utility is the principle. That books are the basis, you know, preaching is the essence, purity is the force, and utility is the principle. I mean, I usually take those as standard by which to guide myself. That the main thing is somehow or other be Krishna conscious, as Rupa Goswami says, the first rule of Krishna consciousness is to remember Krishna, and the second rule is to never forget Krishna. And of course, this should be applied by someone who is mature. It's not that a new bhakti could come in and say, you know, helps me remember Krishna when I smoke marijuana. You know, I can chant better, job, I can concentrate better, smoking marijuana and taking LSD. No, that must be applied by a realized soul, someone who's actually realized in Krishna consciousness. So in order to preach Krishna consciousness, which Srila Prabhupada is or the purport is directly indicating here that the method to become detached is to engage something in preaching. That's what it says in the purport. If you own a luxurious mansion, you should install a deity and hold regular programs to propagate Krishna consciousness. Not just sit in your little house and enjoy your deity worship. That's like Kanishka Adhikari or materialistic devotee. But to propagate Krishna consciousness. And Prabhupada said we want devotees who are like fighters or kshatriyas in propagating Krishna consciousness, not sit-down devotees. This is a heavy statement Prabhupada made. And Prabhupada even said in the final days, let me leave this world like a kshatriya, you know, fighting for Krishna. I'm paraphrasing Prabhupada's words, of course. So that is whatever talents we have, whatever facility we have, whatever wealth we have, as mentioned here, is used in Krishna service, but in order to maximize the preaching. How do you maximize the preaching? Prabhupada said, what is the use of your giving a class? What is the use of your preaching? Unless they engage in Krishna's service and take up Krishna consciousness. The Prabhupada said that to one sannyasi who was going out and giving lectures at the university. And the sannyasi was just bragging and giving so many lectures. But who has joined the movement? You know, has to be some practice. Prabhupada was a very practical person. It wasn't like high in the sky, you know, fairy tale, whatever it is, where you just, oh, I feel good, Prabhupada. I've been thinking of Radha and Krishna today. I realize my spiritual identity. Can you imagine what it would be like if you went to Prabhupada and say, Prabhupada, I realized I'm a gopi. Prabhupada would say, just do something practical. You know, work now, samadhi later, as Prabhupada said. You know, Prabhupada, so Prabhupada was a very practical, you know, he looked at the book distribution results, you know, how many books you do. If you do more books, then I'll come in and stay at your temple. If you defeat, you know, and Prabhupada encouraged, I remember there was one marathon we were competing with, Tamal Krishnamaraj. You remember that, of course. And, every day we were calling, myself or Panchatabrita Maharaj, we were calling Tamal Krishnamaraj and telling him how many books we had done. And then he was telling us how, and he was getting angrier and angrier. And we defeated him. Little Venezuela and Mexico together. Defeated Tamal Krishnamaraj. That was one of the highlights of my whole career. Devotees were so ecstatic after the marathon, they carried me around in front of the TVs. I mean, it was like a football game, you know, where they carry the coach around. You remember that, right? So, and Prabhupada, you know, Prabhupada liked that because of the results. You know, what do you have to show for it? Not that you're just like a Rasika Bhakta, you know, that wasn't Prabhupada's mood. That, oh, I love Krishna. Well, if you love Krishna, get off your butt and do something for him. Isn't it? It's like a husband saying to his wife, I love you, I love you, I love you. But he doesn't do a damn thing for her. Doesn't get her any new saris. Doesn't buy her jewelry. Doesn't pay the bills. But he's just sitting all day, I love you, I love you, I love you. That's like the story of Tulsi Das. You know the story of Tulsi Das? Tulsi Das, he was in love with his wife. His wife's father gave him a cloth shop. And he was so much in love with his wife that every time someone came to buy a cloth in the cloth shop, he didn't sell it to them because he thought if it's, they want to buy it, it's so nice, I should give it to my wife. So there were no sales. He gave it to his wife, and his wife was thinking, you know, it's nice to get saris. She had a pile of saris up to the ceiling, basically. And she said to him, basically, this similar thing to what Bilba Mangal Thakur was told, if you love Krishna so much, you'd be a pure devotee. And she said it in a little harsh way, therefore Tulsi Das left home. And, you know, which is good because he became a great devotee of Krishna, of Lord Rama at that time. So love means you do something for the beloved. At least that's my definition of love, right? And so you maximize what you do. I mean, if you have millions of dollars and you get your wife a 5- and 10-cent dime store, a Walmart, they don't have 5- and 10-cent stores anymore, but a Walmart ring, you know. You know, you go into Walmart, you can get a very nice ring for, what, $10, $15 or something like that. And it looks nice, but of course your wife will discover it's not a diamond. And you have so much money, why be a cheapskate? So the whole point is to maximize your service. So what Krishna West means, getting to the point, that's all introduction, is to maximize the preaching. To give people an experience of Krishna consciousness that, of the essence of Krishna consciousness, not the external things that we consider Vedic or may or may not be Vedic, but to give people the experience of the essence. What's the essence? The essence is Bhagavatam, the essence is chanting the holy names, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. These are prasadam, vegetarianism, you know, reincarnation, all the different philosophical, you know, Siddhantas, conclusions, without driving them away with something that is just too much for them. And I was telling the story yesterday, and I've told it all over the world, how I was driven away by the Krishna consciousness from the external aspects, basically for 1 or 2 years, because of what people consider to be essential aspects of Krishna consciousness were not essential. My first visit to a temple, actually my first visit to a preaching center was in Gainesville, Florida. That was nice. Garga Muni was in Gainesville, Florida. This was in 1969. And he was, we had a lunch program. We all sat down together and everybody chanted Hare Krishna, which I enjoyed very much. And we all picked up different instruments like tambourines and triangles and things like that. It was fun. And then we ate. And that was nice. So I became a little interested. So I thought, well, let me visit some of the temples to see what they're like. So I went to the Boston Temple in the middle of the winter, unheated, which is Vedic, because heat is not Vedic. Anyway, so it's Maya to use, you know, heat or electricity. So we went to the temple, and they put me in the basement, which is also Vedic, because I was on the lower rung of Krishna consciousness. I wasn't advanced at that time, you know, so put someone on the lower level. So they put me in the basement, and it was cold. I had a sleeping bag. It was all right. So I woke up in the morning. I said, you know, where's the shower? The shower was just like a hose in the basement. And then after that was all right. You know, I was used to camping out. I was pretty austere. And I said, you know, where's the toilet? So there's the toilet. So they said, where's the toilet seat? And I said, there's none. They said, it's none. It's Vedic, you know. You got to step on it. And I said, how do you avoid falling into it? You know, what do you know? What is a Westerner know? And I said, where do you do it? Where do you put toilet paper? And they said, no, that's not Vedic. Use your hands. So by that time I was ready, you know, get me the hell out of here. And then I went to the temple room and, you know, there's a lot of things I couldn't relate to coming from a Judeo-Christian background. Like people were dancing up and down in front of the deities, which is hard, you know, from people from a Judeo-Christian background. You know, some of you may have been devotees like for millions of lifetimes, and but it was difficult. And then there people were running around a bush and bowing down to a bush, and I just went, wow. Indiana Jones in the Temple of Doom, man. I said, well, that's all right. I understand these are cultural things. It was shocking, but, you know, I could accept it. And then the person giving class gave a hellfire and brimstone class, told me how I was living underground, going to be living underground, eating human flesh, short as a dwarf, because Kali Yuga was coming. And they said, you better join the movement right now, you know, practically pointing at me. You better go. And I said, wow, I'm out of here. You know, I was already following the four regulated principles, chanting Hare Krishna, 1969. And at that point I said, you know, I like the process of Krishna consciousness, but those people, whew. And so every time I saw a devotee, from that point forward, I turned my car in the opposite direction, put my pedal to the metal. There were actually three of us together, three friends who had this whole experience. It wasn't just me. And then finally, you know, the saving grace is I met Prabhupada. And then I saw, wow, I want to be like that. Role model type of stuff. I want to be like that. I want to follow that person. And I was able to tolerate all the other things, such as the bald head and the robes and waking up early and the fanatic devotees and all the glubjamins and all those other. I actually started to like glubjamins. After a while, I was taking glubjamin juice for breakfast, like everybody else in the Hare Krishna movement. But anyway, so the point I'm making, there were a lot of things that kept me from joining, or at least freaked me out a little bit in the beginning. And had it been more gradual, probably, looking in hindsight, would say hindsight is 20/20, then I probably would have joined like 2 years earlier. It's interesting, isn't it? And it was only by meeting Prabhupada that I joined. I was also impressed by Vrita Nandamarsh, who I met too. I thought, he's a very nice devotee. He wasn't fanatical. The previous president in Gainesville, Florida, where I joined, was Amarendra, and he was fanatical. Amarendra was a student radical before he joined the Hare Krishna movement. You all know Amarendra?
Yeah.
I think most of you do. And he used to preach Krishna consciousness like the student radicals would burn down buildings in the 1960s. I was just like, wow! The guy's frightening. He almost killed me even after I joined the movement, because I asked Prabhupada for initiation, like 2 weeks after I met Prabhupada. And he was so angry that I didn't go through the proper channels, he was taking a mop and was going to beat me with it. That was Amarendra. So, my early days in the Hare Krishna movement. I was a veteran of foreign wars and domestic wars. So the point is that we should seek a way, and even now, all right, because talking about the modern day and age, people are perhaps a little more conservative than they were in the 1960s. In the 1960s, we weren't conservative at all, practically. It was the hippie generation. Men had flowers in their hair. They still do, of course, some men. So, long hair, and people didn't bathe for like 3 years. That was the hippies. So they were open to anything, taking drugs, whatever. So people were much more open to different lifestyles in those days. And they were more open to austerity. Like joining a brahmachari ashram, that wasn't the problem for me, because I was used to austerity, camping out. That was the generation, I was used to that. But nowadays, we were talking yesterday about how to bring some of the woofers and other people to Krishna consciousness, and we were talking about how to give them nice facility so that they feel comfortable. During the 1960s, you could just stick them in a hole in the wall. It was like a New Vrindavan when I went there. First time I went there, I said, where's the bathroom? There wasn't even a toilet then. They said, it's up the hill. that was after I was a devotee. It's up the hill. There's a trench in the ground. You'll see it. Don't fall into it. Be careful. You remember that? And then
I dug a trench.
And there was lime in the trench or something like that. You put lime in the trench. You just have to stoop over the trench. So for 2 or 3 days, I didn't want to go to the bathroom. And the only other bathroom was a little shed with an oil barrel in it. You remember that? Oil barrel that you went to the bathroom over an oil barrel, and every few days they took a forklift and they had to take the oil barrel and dump it out somewhere.
Was it a forklift? It was a team of horses.
A team of horses. I don't know. I didn't stay around to watch it being done.
It was a great service, actually, because after you surrendered to doing that service, you could be asked to do anything, and you're like, yes, for
forklift. So there was a lot of surrender. I remember one time in New Vrindavan that I had a high fever, and I was lying down in my sleeping bag, and someone came up to me, who shall remain nameless, and he said, "Why aren't you working?" And I said, "I have a fever." He said, "Well, the best way to overcome fever is work." And he began to hit me with a stick. You know, I was lucky by that time I had met Prabhupada. Because otherwise, I mean, God knows what I would have done to him. Of course, I did get even later on. What happened later on is he sent me out chopping wood, and there was some wood that you couldn't cut, even with a chainsaw, basically, you know. You know the type of wood I'm talking about? It's just like, some of the wood there was like a stone. And I kept hitting it, and I couldn't put a scratch in it. He comes by and says, "What are you doing, you lazy bum?" He said, "Step out of the way, I'll show you how to do this." So I stepped out of the way, and he kept hitting it. And he couldn't put a scratch in the wood. And I started laughing, and he went away with steam coming out of his ears. So I did get even, so later on that day. And then, you know, it was a blessing because I got sent in the kitchen after that because I couldn't chop wood. And I worked with Shruti Kirti cooking for Prabhupada and for the devotees. So anyway, I mean, these are all the challenges we had to put up with that were easier for us now. But nowadays, if we look at people, they're actually a little bit more pampered. They're not used to that. So Prabhupada, even when he went to India, his whole idea was to establish an American house, you know, Western house, so that people could live comfortably. You know, Prabhupada understood that was important. Even though he did, like, encourage his early devotees to accept austerities. I mean, Timal Krishnamurti came up to Prabhupada in Bombay when they were living outside and there were rats around. And he said to Prabhupada, you know, there's rats around. We need doors, you know, to close our rooms and everything like that. And then Prabhupada said to him, "Don't you want to get purified?" I mean, that was all right in the beginning days of the movement. But you still can't use that same slogan of purification to force people to do things that would really freak them out. I mean, I remember that this word purification is misused so many times. And if you eat too many hot peppers, then you have diarrhea and you're getting purified. Everything's purification. You know, if you get Ebola, you're getting purified. So, I mean, purification means to surrender to Krishna and chant Hare Krishna properly. So the point is we have to present people who are coming to the Krishna conscious movement to with a circumstance that is physically, let's say, attractive or acceptable, psychologically acceptable too, and emotionally acceptable. And that's what Krishna West is. That to present people with the essence of Krishna consciousness in a circumstance where they feel comfortable, rather than imposing things that would actually freak them out, to use, for lack of a better word. And that's what we're doing. It's been very successful. It's not a deviation from Krishna consciousness. It's simply the same philosophy, the same mantra. It's actually completely, purely Krishna conscious, much more than all the yoga programs that people are doing. We don't do yoga. We don't have hatha yoga there. We don't do physical yoga. It's just bhakti yoga. 100% bhakti yoga. So it's completely the pure thing. No, it's not a bridge program. It's a program to bring people into pure Krishna consciousness. And if people decide to stay, you know, wearing Western clothes, that's fine. They can become Krishna conscious wearing Western clothes. I mean, first of all, you gotta give up your body at the time of death, which means also giving up your clothes. And then Krishna will give you an appropriate outfit in the spiritual world. So, you know, wearing Western clothes is fine, although sometimes people decide to put on saris and dhotis too. I mean, my experience is that we have some people that we were cultivating with Krishna West, and it came time for a ceremony called Vyas Puja. So we invited some of the people to come to the Vyas Puja. You know, the devotees were thinking, oh, they're going to get freaked out. But they liked it very much. So they actually get attracted to the temple worship after some time. So it's pure Krishna consciousness, and it brings people into Prabhupada society. And the whole idea is to bring millions or change the world. Tatena kampam susha mikshmana. So the whole idea is that to create a revolution in the misdirected lives of an impious civilization. Tadvadzi sago janataka viplavo Yasmin Pratislogma Vadavachapi Namanantashi Yashoni Katani Yatrinvandi Gayanti Grinandi Yatasadavaha. This is a verse in Bhagavatam. That's what the Krishna conscious movement is meant to do. We're not interested in just getting one or two or three new devotees. We want to change society. Or as Bhakti, as Prabhupada said, that the movement would be successful when the Supreme Court justices are wearing tilak. So, you know, we want to change society. We're a revolutionary movement. Not just a tiny little movement. And so Krishna Weston's endeavor. And there's other endeavors too, like the Loft program and other endeavors that are being made. And of course we have our agricultural program, which is also a program like that. It's meant to bring people to Krishna consciousness. If you're simply growing vegetables so you can eat nicely, what is the value, isn't it? The whole idea is to bring people through vegetables, through cooking classes, through natural living, high thinking, to Krishna consciousness, to the chanting of Krishna's name. So, anyway, any questions or comments? Because you asked me to speak about Krishna West. Yes, Yogi.
So, based on utility as a principle, then, Gauranga potatoes is, in one sense, Vedic. Right?
Yeah. No, anything is used to glorify Krishna. If it attracts people to Krishna consciousness, if it's prepared nicely and Krishna likes it, it's Vedic. Cookies are Vedic? Why not? Because what is Veda means knowledge.
I have a question also. My question is, we may not know exactly what Krishna had, but we certainly know what our topmost Acharya had.
Yes.
Not only Prabhupada, but Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu.
Yes. But there's different tastes. We're personalists, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not that we're impersonalists. I mean, some things that Prabhupada liked to eat, I may not like to eat, and I may like to eat certain things that Prabhupada didn't eat. Does that make me in Maya? I mean, first of all, we're not supposed to copy Prabhupada. There's anusar, anukar. Imitate is one thing. I mean, sometimes I see devotees imitating Prabhupada's voice. Bhagavad Gita. You know, what is that? It sounds weird. You're imitating Prabhupada. Serve Prabhupada and follow Prabhupada in the footsteps of the Acharyas. There's no statement that we should imitate the Acharyas. We should follow in their footsteps and serve them. Like Prabhupada was very pleased. I mean, I remember when Tamal Krishnamurti presented him with all these new devotees. And they each had a flower in their hand. That pleased Prabhupada. So the whole idea is to please the Acharya. And, Why do we have to like the same thing that our spiritual master likes? I mean, is there some injunction like that? That we have to like eating the same things? I mean, I do like the same things, but I've adjusted things for my health. I do like pakoras, I do like all that. Also, when Prabhupada ate, he didn't eat like us Westerners do. If you watch Prabhupada eat, he would take a sweet ball and take one bite out of it. Other than that time with the cookies, when I would watch Prabhupada eat, he would just take a little bite and he would chew something 20 or 30 times and relish the taste of prasadam. When we eat, we take the globjamins and we have a contest how many globjamins we can eat. You ever have those contests?
Yeah, I used to coach them.
Or on Balaram's appearance day, we have a contest how much honey we could drink. You ever have those contests? I won because I would, when persons turn their back, I pour the honey on the ground. Anyway, so I cheated. So, I definitely like those things. I mean, I love pakoras. I mean, when they're fried in ghee, pakoras are fried in oil, you can have them. Prabhupada said oil's for the outside, ghee's for the inside. Many people join the movement because of ghee, not because of oil. I mean, I remember the first time I ate cauliflower pakoras, it was just, they were exploding in my mouth, you know, the taste. That was the ghee. And so, anyway, so Prabhupada said we should cook with ghee. I mean, there's so many things. So, yeah, we don't want to imitate Prabhupada. I mean, if you try to imitate, then you should also imitate Prabhupada's sleeping habits or resting habits. You know, why don't you get up at 12 o'clock at night and start writing literature? Can you do that? I mean, if I get up at 12 o'clock and get by with so little rest, I'll be a zombie the next day.
With the speak of people imitating Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu.
Yeah.
That would be ridiculous.
But there's certain things, you know, that that I'm lamenting that we don't do the way Prabhupada did. That's just, Prabhupada taught us to dance a certain way, and everybody doesn't dance in that way anymore. Isn't it? Nobody dances. The Swami's, I mean, it's really beautiful. I remember there was a whole temple full of people swaying back and forth in front of the deities. It was ecstatic. And now, I'm not criticizing anyone's style of dancing, but now nobody, practically nobody does that. Everybody just goes back and forth, or something like that. But they don't do Prabhupada style dancing anymore. I miss it. I mean, because that was Prabhupada. Prabhupada taught us how to dance. Yet we don't do that in general anymore. Yeah, so more questions.
Sorry, Your Grace, I like to cook cookies, Prabhupada cookies.
That's nice.
Distribution, you know. But I was curious, do you remember what cookies he really liked that much?
They were basically sugar cookies.
Sugar cookies.
Sugar cookies. With flour, sugar, and butter. And maybe, a little spices or something like that. But that's what we used to cook for Prabhupada. Sugar cookies. I mean, Prabhupada liked sugar. I mean, one time Prabhupada poured a mound of sugar on someone's Sesvamari's chapati and said, eat it. Prabhupada liked sugar. There's nothing wrong. I mean, Prabhupada said, Brahmins like the taste of sweet things. So there's nothing wrong with liking. I also like the taste of sweet things, but, I've sort of given them up because of my health. Yeah, couple of bunch.
So the deity schedule, for example, the reason that we wake the deity at a certain time and all the procedure that follows that, the arti and all that, correct me if I'm wrong, it's my understanding is that we're doing that in replication of how it's done actually in Goloka Vrindavan. In other words, Mother Yashoda wakes Krishna.
It's the Ashtakalaya Leela.
Right. So likewise, the diet, the menu that we offer Krishna is in replication also?
Not necessarily. Certainly kheer, milk products, yes. Right. But other things like Puris? No. I mean, you have the song about Bhakti Vinod Thakur, Luji Chini, Zarapuni, Ladu Rasabali. Not necessarily. Some things yes, some things no.
So,
I mean, certainly there was no sugar cane when Krishna was present on the planet. So they sweetened with honey or with the sap from the trees or something like that, yeah.
So therefore, would it be correct, therefore, to offer the deity the foodstuffs that reflect your relationship with the land?
I think so.
Krishna's energy.
Yeah.
What's easily accessible?
Prabhupada was the one who actually said that if you eat food that's in season, grown locally, you'd be healthy. I mean, Prabhupada was the original locavore before that term became popular. So, you should be practical. You should be practical. And if, if there's no flowers locally, I mean, you should try to grow some locally. But it's sort of weird to import flowers from thousands of miles away that have so much poison on them, they would kill any person with a material body. Like they have these carnations from Colombia. And there's so many chemicals on them because they can't come in the United States if they have any bugs. They want to make sure every single living entity is dead, including you if you put it on.
Well, including the people who grow them.
Yeah, the people who grow them get cancer.
In haciendas, where there used to be a local culture, a land-based local culture that's been pushed out of the way by absentee ownership. Now they grow carnation. Them come here, they're flown or often transported to the NAFTA free trade area across borders with cocaine in them because they're easy to hide. And then we offer that to the deity thinking, this is...
Yeah, I mean, it's abominable.
As if Krishna doesn't know all the steps that went into...
It's abominable. It's actually abominable to offer that to Krishna. And there's no sense to it. Other than the chemical scent, if there's such a scent like that. So, it's better you do things locally. I mean, if you don't have flowers, grow a few or in a greenhouse if you can, or just leaves. I mean, that's preferable. Although, of course, I can't tell that to the Pujaris. They freak out and get angry with me if I say that. But it's preferable to have a leaf garland than to give a poison garland to Krishna. Which would you rather have on you? A poison garland or a leaf garland?
I'll just take a sandalwood garland.
Sandalwood. Yeah. I mean, if you think Krishna's a person, so which would you rather have? So you can project that on Krishna. And you would rather eat something. I mean, grown locally is nice if we can do that. Yeah.
What I was Doctor. Just wondering whether you could speak a little bit about the kirtan standards in the temple. There's a kirtan standards committee, and recently I was listening to a lecture by Jayadvaita Maharaj.
Yeah.
His Holiness said that Srila Prabhupada never sang anything except the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. After the first preliminary prayer, like Vivashtakam and then Jai Shri Krishna and then...
Yeah.
And then he says nowadays we have all kinds of words, Nitai, Goranga, Haribol, Haribol, and those things Srila Prabhupada never sang.
During the kirtan.
Right.
Yeah, during the kirtan Prabhupada didn't. That's right. That's right. And
until I heard that particular lecture, I had no idea that these things are not to be sung and only the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra is to be sung.
And Jai Shri Krishna, Chaitanya, Pranam mantras, yeah. And then what I do is at the end of the kirtan, I pay respects to the deities. And, you know, I think that's allowable. I say, you know, Nitai Gaur Haribol about, you know, of course, Gaur Nitaya there. And then I say, Radha Radha Kanta, you know, Radha Radha Kanta. And I just do that one or two times. But the kirtans, yes, should just be Hare Krishna and Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya. And Prabhupada also said you can do Hare Haraya Nama Krishna Yadavaya Namaha. So these are the different Maha mantras. Because that was written by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, that particular stanza. Because Lord Chaitanya was asked one time, how do you chant the holy names of Krishna? And he answered, Hare Haraya Nama Krishna Yadavaya Namaha, Yadavaya Manava Keshavaya Namaha. So that's another Maha mantra that was written by Lord, or spoke by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. But yes, you're absolutely right. Things should be, you know, very simple. Yeah, people got into different mantras. Goranga, Goranga. And then they could say Haribol like 1,000 times, but Haribol means to chant the holy names. Chant, chant, chant. So why don't you chant? Why are you just saying you should chant, but you're not chanting? So, yes, I agree. That's a kirtan standard. And people shouldn't be just chanting Rade, Rade, like that. You know, at the end, you can pay respects to the deities, the names of the deities. That's what I do. Because I want to pay respects to the deities. Like in New Vrindavan, they'd say Radha Vrindavan Chandra. You know, which is fine. Or Jaya Jagannath. Because we don't have Jagannath deities here, I don't say Jaya Jagannath. But if we had Jagannath deities, I'd say Jaya Jagannath, Jaya Jagannath, Jaya Baladev. I know. But on the altar, the worshipful deities. I mean, if I went around to all the pictures everywhere, I'd be just chanting mantras all day long. Jai Kurmadev, Jai Kurmadev. Jai, who else do we have here? Anyway, I'd have to go through all the incarnations of God and then some. Jai Hayagriva, Jai Hayagriva. Jai Lakshmi Narayan, Jai Lakshmi Narayan. So, you know, I just stick with the deities on the altar. And that just takes 1 minute, a half a minute. At the end of your time. You're right. Good point. So, yes, Shamala.
Maharaj, you were talking about trying to be maybe a little more accommodating and more practical in some aspects, like, you know, when we preach to people. I've had this experience, like, in big festivals or when we have guests.
Yeah.
Sometimes, just like, everybody expects, or maybe we are trying to keep the old school, that, for example, in big festivals, that everybody should be, you know, observing a strict fasting, or everybody should do some things. I have this sad experience. My middle son was one time in Hawaii, mm-hmm. staying with my sister. And he was fasting completely, I think it was a mastery.
Mm-hmm. And he has a very, very light, very thin complexion like myself. And he passed out.
Shoot.
Seriously, he passed out. Mm-hmm. He broke his nose. He broke his glasses. He was unconscious for a few minutes.
Oh, my God.
So I don't think, you know what, if Rapa would find out something like that, I'm pretty sure he would be upset. He would say, we have to do the practical thing. If you cannot do it because your body is weak, mm-hmm. because you are a woman who is pregnant, or you have a small baby, do whatever you can. You know, like my Guru Maharaj, usually he has a little bit of fruit, mm-hmm. and maybe some water. But sometimes it's like, you know, the devotees with good intentions, they
sometimes
they're pouring out, you know, and they're pouring fingers. Or they pour big things in the kitchen. Nobody should be feeding. Don't eat. It's fasting. So
yeah.
I think we have to be a little more sensitive to personal needs.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, devotees got more fanatic after Prabhupada left. Like this whole thing about staying up all night in the Ekadasi and not drinking on the Ekadasi. I mean, that is, you know, it's mentioned in the Hari Bhaktivilas, obviously. But that started to become a fashion in ISKCON after Prabhupada left. I mean, not, as far as I remember, I don't remember anyone doing it when Prabhupada was on the planet. And so then you have devotees staying up all night, and then the next day they're like zombies. And sometimes people are not drinking water when they're sweating. You know, it's a hot climate. They got kidney damage. And people say, well, I got kidney stones. You know, why'd you get kidney stones? Well, maybe they were fasting too much from water. You can get kidney stones if you don't take water and you're sweating the same day. I mean, there's so many things like that. You have to be practical. Prabhupada was practical. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur would one time he gave some of his disciples rice on the Ekadasi so they'd go out and preach. I'm not saying we should do that. I mean, we're not from Bengal, at least I'm not. So I can live without rice. But, yeah, be practical. I mean, sometimes on a fast day, I mean, I don't faint on a fast day, but if I fast too much, my eyes don't focus, and then, you know, I try to read, I can't read. It's impossible. When you get older, you experience these things. And then the eyes won't focus on the page. So all I have to do is sit all day long waiting for the fast to be over because I can't read. I can't concentrate. So therefore, I'll take a little fruit. See, yeah, you have to be practical. Not fanatic about these things. Yeah.
That incident, if I remember correctly, it was the Sankirtan devotees, book distributors in Chicago.
Yeah.
And they had mentioned to Prabhupada that on Ekadasi, when they got to the airport, book distribution, that they were, you know, really suffering through the day. Weak, not even grain. Take grain. Because the book, the principle of serving or Chaitanya's mission
is more important.
Was more important.
Yeah. In those days, we didn't have buckwheat or quinoa. Nobody heard about those things, right? You had no grain substitutes. I mean, they were just potatoes. And who could live on potatoes? Yeah.
All right. In relation to purity of the force, is there any difference? Say in distributing Prabhupada's books, if I fanned out on book distribution and I give someone some paraphernalia of some sort, or I give them a citation for partying too hard, and then
the point
and then as a byproduct I give them Prabhupada's book, is there a difference between them getting that book from Prabhupada, and if I'm just out there distributing Prabhupada's books, no paraphernalia, and I'm talking to them mm-hmm. about my spiritual master, and this is why I want you to have this book.
Is there any difference? I mean, obviously there's a difference. What, it's preferable for the direct preaching. However, because that was definitely a pointed question, however, either some people are not as comfortable or they haven't been trained up or the circumstances are different, like everybody in the street is drunk or something like that. So sometimes adjustments have to be made. like that. But obviously it is preferable to give out books if you could preach on the merit of your relationship with Krishna, Prabhupada, and the book itself. That's the preferable. Because you're going to be encouraging people to read the book. But, you know, there are other circumstances. I mean, just like we have this Motel Gita program where people aren't paying for the book, we're just putting them in the motels. You know? So it would be preferable if we can give people the book and they gave money and then they would reciprocate with us. But it's a system by which people can read Bhagavad Gita, and many people become devotees that way.
I mean, back in the old days, we had quotas.
Yeah.
You know, so to some degree, you could say the stress was more on bring back this amount of lakshmi.
Right.
Rather than purity being the force, go out and
distribute books. Yeah.
Distribute books as purely as you could. Prabhupada often said, "Judge by the result."
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that the result would be better if we preached more purely?
Yeah, I definitely feel the result would be better because, I mean, we had so much, what we say, blowback from those days in the 1970s, where people got burnt out. You know, it became a joke about the Hare Krishnas in the airport because we were putting pressure on people. I mean, even one time I was going to the airport and I was wearing Western clothes. This is in 1972 or 73. I was working for the BBT. And I was going to see a printer, so I was wearing Western clothes. And then I was going through the Chicago airport, and a lady hit me up, you know. She pinned a flower on my lapel or something. And I said, "I'm a brahmachari, get away!" The poor lady jumped back like 100 feet, you know. She had a heart attack. So, you know, it created a bad reputation. And also there's other, you know, the other techniques, change up and things like that, that don't need to be mentioned. So it's better if we can preach purely and distribute books on their merit. However, there are other programs, not cheating programs, but there are other programs that can be utilized if that does, you know, if we can't do it for one reason or other. You know, I'm not going to denigrate any program that distributes books. I mean, like here, you had one devotee from Chicago who sponsored how many cases of books? 20 cases or something?
Yeah, studio sponsored 60 cases.
60 cases of Bhagavad Gita's. So he's distributing books. I mean, obviously, for some reason or other, he's not going out and Sankirtan distribute books, but he's getting the credit, you know, so. So any other questions? Quick questions, because
just some quick is there's two instances back in Birmingham when we were out there in Sankirtan, you know, repeatedly people would tell us that where have you all been? I haven't seen you all for 30 years. We're doing Harinam. And down here in the French Quarter on the Saturdays I take out the Harinam party.
Yeah.
And I'm dressed in my Karmi clothes and they're dressed in dhotis.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm walking about 30 feet ahead of the Harinam party and this couple gets out of the car. And the man says excitedly to his wife, and they don't know I'm a Hare Krishna because I'm in my karmic clothes. And the devotee is coming up behind me, and he says, "Honey, it's the Krishnas." You know? So it's like we made an impression years ago, but you know what I mean? And some of it might be bad too, but you know, we made an impression in our consciousness.
No, I'm not criticizing the Harinam. I mean, that's wonderful. Krishna West is basically about cultivating people on a one-to-one basis. Just another thing, people join religious societies because of relationships, not because of philosophy. They may be attracted by the food or the prasadam, but nobody will join unless there's loving relationships. And that's one of the things, like I said, it was the loving relationship with Prabhupada that got me to join, not with so many of the other devotees, because they weren't so loving at that time. But if we have, I mean, let's say, give an example. One time I went to a Mormon ceremony and they were so loving with me that I almost joined them. You know, I walked in and they said, what's your name? I said, you know, Veer Krishna Goswami. Oh, Swami, how are you? You know, dressed in a dhoti. This is in Hawaii, actually. And they said, how are you? Everybody, I want you to meet Swami. Shake his hand. Hey, Swami, how are you doing? Thank you for coming. And someone walks in here, and not here, but, you know, in Hare Krishna temple. First of all, they get ignored. Someone can come here for 100 times before someone actually speaks to them. And then secondly, if they have to sit down for the Sunday feast, all the devotees push their way in first before the devotee take the Sunday feast. I'm not saying it happens here. It's just like a general observation. And the, you know, what is the love? The loving relationships. I mean, you don't want to be too pushy with people. Another thing that happened to me when I first came to the temple in Gainesville was they wouldn't let me read Prabhupada's books. They were too pushy. You know, I walked in, I picked up this Upanishad and sat down to read it, and the person came up and said, I'm going to tell you about Krishna, basically. I said, can I read? And they said, well, you have to hear from a devotee. And so I wasn't allowed to, they didn't say, you know, you're not allowed to read, but they said, you have to hear from me to understand this book. I said, I just want to read Prabhupada's books. And they wouldn't let me read Prabhupada's books in the temple. So that's too friendly. Not really friendly, pushy. So, but basically that's it, you know, someone walks in, I mean, we're like a business, you know, someone walks into your business, you welcome them, you know, and say, can I help you in any way? Is this your first time here? Here's a gift, you know, if we're coming the first time, here's a Bhagavad Gita. We always do that. And then first impressions are lasting impressions. People remember that the whole lot. The first impression I have with anybody, with Prabhupada, it's just like fixed or frozen in my consciousness. And other impressions I had with Prabhupada are there too, but they're not as strong as that first time I saw Prabhupada. So you got to remember, the first time people see us as devotees, that's what they're going to remember the rest of their lives. Yeah.
I had a wonderful experience traveling for many years with Radha Swami. Before he took some notes. At Brahmacharya, we had a rotating group of cities that we would do bhajan and then city to city. And I was extremely well organized. I had the band meet and everything was put in its right place, and we had a schedule that I was hoping we could maintain. And Maharaj is his extraordinary care with people, befriending them, and kind of exuding that loving, caring attitude towards everybody made the schedule impossible. Well, I'd be packing everything up and going, you know, getting ready to go to the next city that we would rotate around to. He'd be just going on and on, befriending people in such a wonderful way. So it was a source of humor and contention between us all the time. We were good friends.
Yeah.
It wasn't a big deal. But then I later realized that, you know, what's actually working here is not how many cities we go to or how many cooking classes we do. It's the fact that people become endeared to him by his care of how carefully he handles the relationship. And therefore they become endeared to Prabhupada and the philosophy of Krishna consciousness.
Exactly.
Because he was the conduit by his loving attitude.
Yeah.
So it's a great lesson.
Good lesson. Good. Very good example. Yeah, so we are also conduits too. You know, we're supposed to be conduits and reaching out and loving with people. Yeah, rather than quantity, quality is important. So I think it's time for Krishna Prasadam as well as Krishna West. So thank you very much. We'll see everybody for the Sunday feast program. If it's real dark, we can show slides for the, if it's this dark. You have it. Tapapunj, you have a good projector, don't you?
I have a PowerPoint projector, but I don't know how to use it.
Well, I know how to use it. If you have, I just have a tiny one with me that won't show up during the day. Okay, so that, because I wanted to show, one thing I was thinking I could tell stories about Braj and show some of the aerial shots we just shot of the different holy places around Govardhan, which would be interesting for people for the Sunday program. something different. Because we have this helicopter, and we shot a lot of interesting things, Radha Kund, and anyway, all the places, and there's stories, of course, of each place, too. And there is rough video footage, but it's really interesting. People really like it. People really like it. Okay.
Do you still want to try to sell some Bhagavatam?
Yeah. I mean, if guests come who are there other than the devotees who are not interested in the Bhagavatam. So, I'm teasing.
We do get a good number of guests sometimes because of the weather.
Oh, but if people come who don't have the books, yeah, I'd like to just make a sales pitch. You know, we can sell the whole set of Bhagavatam special today, a special discount for you. Oh, yeah. Okay. Actually, I've been encouraged to do that by Vaisheshika Peru, that every Sunday feast, if there's guests, you know, you give a lecture and you just mention and extol, you know, talk about the wonderful nature of the Bhagavatam.